Hello and welcome to episode 5 of The Office Block with me, Paul Dillon. On today's show, we talk tech workers and the conditions and rights of tech workers in the workplace. There are 92,000 people working in information and communication in Ireland, and the stats show that trade union organisation is weaker here than almost any other sector of the economy. But change may be afoot. Internationally, at least, there's a big move towards organising tech workplaces and discussing how they can be made better. One example is the work being done by the Game Workers Unite group, who are advocating for workers' rights and better workplace in the games industry. They have featured in The Guardian as well as a host of titles aimed at the industry, and I caught up with their acting chief organiser in the UK, Declan Peach, to talk about his work. I also caught up with Wendy Liu of the Tech Workers Coalition and discussed her work and her views on working in tech. Declan, welcome to The Office Block and thanks for coming on the show. You're the chief organiser of Game Workers Unite, but tell us first about your own background and how you came to be part of the games industry.
So like most people in the games industry, I sort of got super into computer games and sort of clambered for a job making them from quite a young age. And I just sort of looked for a games sort of degree and did bachelor's and a master's and just looked for whatever job I could doing either quality assurance or design or whatever. I found a job in a small indie studio of about 10 people, went bust, and then I found a big studio of about 70 people that actually is a much more secure position. And yeah, I've only been in the industry for about a year and a half. I've not been, I've been doing this for long, and I'm already like acting chief organizer of this trade union organization.
Declan, can you give us a sense of the scale of the industry, both in terms of gaming as a modern entertainment industrial complex that has surpassed the likes of Hollywood, and then, of course, the amount of people that are involved in the games industry and its subsidiaries?
Okay. I mean, yeah, like everything you hear in the news is about how gaming as an industry is just growing and growing and it's getting massive. In the UK, you got so many people who are doing like indie studios and support contracts and loads and loads of different things. So you got like AAA and you got like mobile. They're very different markets, but all in all, you get like, if I was to give it like an estimation, I'd say about 40,000 people work in the UK games industry, and it must be nearing a million across the world.
And tell us about the biggest employers in gaming at the moment, Declan. What are the big household names that people listening to the show might recognise? Just give us a scale of those brands and their profit share of the market.
If you like Rockstar and Ubisoft, Activision, you make Call of Duty and stuff. EA is a huge one. Rockstar, Activision, Ubisoft, EA. There's probably more I'm not thinking of. Sony, Microsoft, yeah, and Nintendo. All of those are active, like in the British Isles, in the UK. All of them are employing people. And you got Crytek. Crytek's a big one as well. There's a lot to be named, and they're all like very big.
And tell us about the indie gaming industry as well, right? Because what I'm conscious of is that for someone who's not familiar with the games industry, it's a little bit more complex than it might first appear, because you've named some of the big employers there, but the whole world of indie gaming is booming. Can you talk a little about that? Because you've got the startup end of this.
You got this like organization called Yuki, UKIE, and they are a... They're basically a group of investors who they're orchestrating everything around the gaming industry. And something they do is they have a big map of all of the companies that are registered in games, and not even accounting for the big employers. Like, you've got close to about 1,000 companies, like small companies all across the UK, that... do various things. They're usually between about 10 and 30 people, or even less than that, 2 and 30 people. And they do stuff like mobile, they do like console games. It's super easy to publish onto a console to get to a mass market if you have a good development team. And they also do stuff like they don't. Some don't even develop games. Some do stuff like, your studio needs things made. We'll make them for you if we can just like get in on the credits, or just not even that, just for money. So there's a lot of companies that aren't even that go completely unheard of in the game industry. And you also get like a lot of freelancers in the game industry, not even in just writing and art. You also get a lot of freelancers who are like, oh, I'll clean up your code, I'll do your project management, I'll
And tell me then, Declan, about your organization, where the name came from, where the idea came from, and how do you deal with this very complex mini labor market where you have very big employers, indie employers, and also freelancers?
Okay, so Game Workers Unite started in January. Oh, well, I think it was before January in the US. And it was a bunch of people in the United States who...
January 2018.
More or less, I think. it got big then because it was a convention called GDC, which is the Game Developers Conference. IATSE, the Tech Workers Union in the US, they funded these group of game developers to be able to form their own labor rights organization. And they handed out lots of flyers, and they handed out a bunch of magazines, actually, explaining the conditions in the games industry. And after that, membership skyrocketed, including when I joined as well. And what happened was they chose to like make many, many chapters across different cities in the US. And then I was like, hey, why don't we do stuff in the UK? Relating to your second thing, it's a ongoing process, I guess, figuring out how to structure a labor union into a way that can tackle this industry, because it's different to how every other industry really orchestrates itself, other than maybe because it's almost between like film and software development. It's mostly software development. You also just have so much freelancing and so much like gig economy stuff.
I'm fascinated by the way that you organize with the chapters and the international element of it. But I'm also very interested in the complexity of it, because there's a lot of different issues that people will experience depending on the work circumstances, depending on who they work for. But can you just describe what kind of issues people are coming to you with, and how do you help?
Yeah, so in the game industry, you get a lot of like employers tend to do a thing where they'll start you on like short contracts, especially in entry level positions where you'll be in like 6 months a contract, and they'll always people come to me and say like my contract's terrible, and they're going to make it even more terrible, where it's like I'm working for 6 months almost minimum wage on doing like quality assurance, and I have to do mandatory overtime that's not compensated and stuff like that. And those are the big issues that people come to me with, and they want to know like how do we negotiate with our employer to not do this, to give us less of a raw deal. And there's also things like discrimination and...
I want to come back to you in a moment to ask you about the relationship with trade unions and that element of it. But I have to just play devil's advocate for a moment, if you don't mind, because there may be a perception that game workers are very well paid, very highly skilled and qualified people who can walk into any job they like. They'd hardly need to be organised into groups or organisations to improve their conditions at work. How would you respond to that?
So, yeah, the thing with the games industry is that we have this intrinsic problem of the culture around it, and how everybody in the games industry really, really wants to work in the games industry. And there's this consistent trend that's happened over the past decade or so in the industry, where employers just realized that everybody who's here really wants to work in this industry, and they basically use it as leverage to be like, we don't really need to pay you as much as... obviously, never say that. Say it in this way, but it's basically like we don't need to pay you as much as if you worked in like film or creative media or software development or anything else with similar skill sets that they could just walk into, really. And that's the problem. That's why people need representation, is because over the past 10 years, things have degraded to the point where you now have quality assurance testers who are just sort of herded into a room, kept on for 6 months, then all sacked, and then the cycle continues. Or, like, you bring on game designers, you make them work crunch time.
Tell me about the crunch, Declan. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should have explained. So crunch time is basically, this is a good example actually of why you need unions, is like, crunch is like, at the end of a project, the average game, computer game project is about a year to a year and a half, and the last three or four months of this project, it's a really common trend that employers will say, all right, we need to like finish everything in the project before release. This publisher has asked us that we have to release on this exact date. We need to get everything polished and bug-free and finished before this date. And you end up working ridiculous amounts of overtime, completely uncompensated, in order to like meet these completely unreasonable deadlines. And you get these deadlines because publishers are in this like rampant competition with each other to bring out as much stuff as humanly possible. But they're making all of these profits doing this, and they are not like, they're both like creating unsustainable schedules for their workforce and not compensating them. Because as I was saying before, like, most game developers are like, it's fine, this is what I want to do, this is par for the course. You have a lot of games nowadays, well, not that many, but like, it's a really common trend in like AAA high budget games, where in the credits it will be like, it'll say stuff like, here's how many takeouts we had over the course of it. It's like how many times we'd have, like, the whole development team has missed, or like most of the development team has missed dinner. And it's like, that's not something to be like proud about. There's a difference between being very committed to what you do and being like having this like really unreasonable expectations pushed upon you. But like, developers become convinced that like they've worked towards this end, and this is what they've like wanted.
Yeah, I can understand, Declan, that, you know, there may be a tendency by some employers to exploit that, because what you're seeing there is perhaps an awful lot of goodwill to, you know, work longer, to, you know, get a project finished and done. But that can be exploited. I want to ask you, Declan, about gender and diversity in the industry. You might explain to our listeners, some who may not be aware of it, about Gamergate and the impact that that's had.
Oh, yeah, that was a really interesting controversy, because it started out with this controversy about journalism and like the it basically was originally a controversy about journalistic integrity, and it completely got hijacked by people in the industry who basically just didn't like there being women in the industry, and they would basically use that as any excuse to they would basically like make any excuse to complain again about female game developers. It's really interesting because you tend to develop female developers that I've spoken to, they have a very diverse opinion range about how the industry is for them, and it tends to be based entirely on like whether or not they interact a lot with the audience. Gaming as a culture has a very loud minority of guys who don't like girls in the games.
This for me is something. I mean, the last experience I had with the game industry, to be honest, was playing Sonic the Hedgehog and so on when I was a teenager, which is many years ago. But speak to me a little about gender as a huge issue in the industry, because I think this is something here that's, you know, you've mentioned Gamergate and you've explained some of that. But how has your organization, how has Game Workers Unite handled these issues?
Well, there was an issue about a month and a half ago, about some people who worked in the developers of... Oh, hold on, you'll have to bear with me. they worked in the developers of with the developers of Guild Wars, and this woman who was a writer, she basically got a bit heated with a guy on Twitter, because this person who's a member of the audience just said, "Hey, I think I know exactly how you should write this game," and it came off as just really pretentious, but like, it wasn't anything. He had like the best intentions, I think, but it came off as super pretentious. And this girl who was like, I have men try to explain to me how to do my job all every day. She basically just went off on one, and she got fired. She was like, she basically said, "This is what it's." What she said was like, "This is what it's like to be in my job. Have people explain to me how to do my job because like, I'm a girl," and she got immediately fired for that. And what we want to do is we stood in solidarity with her and said like, this should have been something that like, there should have been a disciplinary or something of that sort, rather than just getting rid of her, because you just like, you're following the discourse created by this like blatant misogyny in the industry. And yeah, what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to say, hey, we will represent you in these situations, and we will like actually bring to the public eye that these things aren't okay. And yeah, I guess that's the main thing. We've got representatives going to a, what is it? There's a conference in London for women in games, WIGI, WIGI, Women in Games Conference, Women in Games International. And it's organizations like that that we want to try and work closely with to help represent women in games.
Declan, tell me about a little bit about the sort of cultural element of it. People may be familiar with the TV show Silicon Valley, that captures a lot of the ups and downs of the sort of world we've been talking about. For our listeners to get more of an insight here, would you recommend any other shows or films or podcasts that might capture some of the madness of this industry?
That's a really good question.
I've put you on the spot.
Shows or films or podcasts? There's like many, many podcasts by different developers, but I'm not like really into them.
It's a big space, and
okay,
people are more into it than others.
There's a thing called Indie Game the Movie, which is really good. It's about the development of indie games in like the small on the small scale, and it follows a few developers, and they're like, it's a really good example of like what I'm talking about how committed people are, because they're like, as things go on, you realize how insane they get. You end up not liking the guy in it after a while, because he's a bit of a jerk to everyone.
Declan, let's get down to brass tacks for a moment. Tell me just a little bit about your appeal, your pitch to people in the games industry that are listening in. Why should they contact Game Workers Unite, and why should they get involved in the world of trade unions?
A big thing that people always say to me when I say, let's make a trade union, they're like, are we allowed to do that? And I'm like, yes, we're allowed to do that. We're not going to... Basically... you should join a union because, like, we're not going to suddenly just, like, start organizing and go on strike and getting on your boss's bad side. What we want to be able to do is be there to support you when things aren't, like, the best. Think of unions more like a sort of insurance for when you have an issue at work. We are the ones who will know labor laws, and we can be there in all of the meetings that you have with your boss, and we can tell you what you need to know about what your rights are. A union isn't just, we meet every week and we're like, should we go on strike this week? No. what you need a union for is to be able to stop having to have to do crunch, to be able to negotiate with bosses on equal terms and say, hey, here's how I think the industry should like pivot itself, and here's how I think you should better structure your company. And it's not a protest or it doesn't have to start out as a protest. It's a conversation, and it's a way for workers to actually like come together and say, hey, things should be better, let's work towards that goal.
And how tell me about how you're organizing, because I mean here in at the office block we use Slack, at the Financial Services Union, which you know who I work for, we have a tech sector which is strong and growing, but there are cultural differences between tech workers and other workers. I mean, how do you organize? What tools do you use to bring people together?
Mostly Discord. Mostly just Discord chat. We have every chapter of Game Workers Unite has a Discord chat and a mailing list, and we tend to have monthly meetings in person with the view of like establishing chapters in like more regional areas so we can like actually have meet more easily. But usually what we do is we have a Discord chat where we discuss things like, I should probably not say all of the things we discuss. We discuss things like our jobs in certain capacities. And we organize by we organize by Discord chats, and like we try to organize meetings and campaigns, such as trying to... I can't even talk about the campaigns because they're not announced yet. We organize by doing meetings and campaigns and talking to other labor unions about like trying to get support and get like a network going. A big thing about the way we organize is we try to get networks with game developers so that we can do things like, what a union should do is like a place where people who work in the same industry can come together and talk about the things that you can't talk about at work. It's not, which isn't just my work sucks. It can be stuff like, hey, here's what my salary is. Is this like the right amount for my position? Which is a huge thing that people in the games industry never talk about. And they need a better platform. And that's probably a campaign that we will try to, get going in the future, because it's things people have come to me before about, is they don't know if they're getting ripped off in their job. And it's just that, like, organizing by just getting lots of developers together in that context has really helped a lot of people so far as the feedback I've gotten. So
Declan, there's a small and but growing games industry in Ireland. How do people who are interested in your organization get in touch?
Ah, well, I would talk to, I would go on to gameworkersunite.org. That's probably the easiest way. And I would join up with, via their joining, let me just make sure that it's actually, yes, I would go to the Get Involved page and get involved with the international organization. And you can very easily and quickly found an Ireland chapter. It took me about 15 minutes to form the UK chapter. And now we have about 200 people.
Excellent, excellent. And growing. Declan, it's been fascinating. Let's keep in touch, and hopefully we'll just get to draw out some of these issues again. But for now, Declan, thanks for...
Thank you very much, Paul.
...coming
on
the office block. Much appreciated. Wendy, can you explain to us your background and why you wanted to be working in the tech industry in the first place?
Sure. So I started coding when I was pretty young, and as a result, my transition into the tech industry proper just felt kind of natural. So I started building websites when I was 12. I started contributing to open source projects not long after, and it just felt like a natural progression to, you know, just keep writing code. I did computer science in university, and then while I was there, I did a lot of part-time jobs and side projects where I was really just writing code, mostly around web apps. And then I got an internship offer from Google my third year of university, and I took that, and everyone had kind of made it seem like working at Google was this like master prize, like the thing that you should be aiming for. And I was really looking forward to that, but then I just had a really really awful experience almost. It just seemed very mundane. It felt like any other corporate job, and I had believed all the hype around tech and software engineering as being something different. And so even though I did that and I got a return offer and was planning to go back at Google to Google full time, I ended up not doing that just to kind of avoid the what I saw as the corporate drudgery of working at Google full time. Started a tech company, and that was about 3.5 years ago. The tech company has since been sold, and I no longer intend to work in tech or start a company in tech ever again. So I had a bit of a journey, you could say, during that time.
And tell me about your journey from a tech worker to a tech startup founder and then to a tech activist. Tell me, what are the levers here? What's driving this journey?
Yeah, sure. So I had definitely a bit of an unusual journey, and I think the place that I am in now, I could never have imagined that I'd be here. I mean, I never even considered any sort of political activism or anything really remotely resembling politics to be part of my potential career path. So when I first started doing the company, I didn't really know what I was doing, for one. It was the sort of thing that I did because I just really did not want to go back to Google. And I think a lot of other people in tech have this idea that they're going to start a startup, and that because it's going to be their own startup, because they get to do whatever they want, it's going to be so much more fulfilling than working at a big company. And in some ways it is. It is really nice to have freedom. It is nice to work on a small team with people that you like. But at the same time, the big problem for us was that we had this product that we didn't really care about. So essentially what we were building is we were selling consumer data to people. And it just really like this marketing technology space. We weren't really sure what we were doing. We kept pivoting until we, you know, had some sort of product that we could sell to people. But it essentially involved taking data from social media sites and transforming that into, you know, actionable insights that we could sell to corporations to help them develop a better marketing strategy. And that's something that none of us really cared about on a personal level. It wasn't some sort of problem that, you know, kept us up at night. We did it because, for one, the technology was, at least for me, it was fun to build, and it was like a really cool technical challenge, but also because we didn't really know what we were supposed to do. There is this idea in the whole startup world that you're supposed to solve problems based on just like trying things, right? Like you know, if you're a smart young person, all you have to do is like assemble a good team, get some money, and then just like keep trying to build some products that people will buy. And there's very little about building something that's actually socially useful. A lot of the message that venture capitalists and other prominent founders like to peddle is that it's all about solving for the customer, right? You build something that people will use, and that's all that matters. It's just growth. All you have to care about is user growth, without really thinking, am I building something that's actually useful for the world in the first place? And that's definitely something that myself and my co-founders bought into. We didn't really care what we were building. We just saw this startup as some sort of a jumping off point for whatever we would do next. And you know, there's always this idea that if we have a great startup right now, you know, we manage to sell for a lot of money or whatever, then we can go on and do what we actually really want to do. But none of us really knew what we wanted to do. It was always this thing kind of like that we kept in our minds to try to justify ourselves to ourselves so we could sleep better at night, even though we knew what we were doing was kind of unethical in terms of, you know, violating user privacy, and also just really ultimately meaningless, not something that the world actually needed. For one, because we had so many competitors who were doing essentially the same thing we did with technology that wasn't that different from ours. And, you know, what were we actually innovating on? Not very much, really. And so kind of as a result of spending several years doing that and being submerged in this whole like marketing, advertising technology world, I just got really disillusioned, and I started thinking, why am I doing this? Is there a good reason that I'm spending, you know, 70, 80 hours a week working on this technology that I fundamentally don't believe in? And I started kind of like rethinking all the assumptions that had got me to that point. I started thinking about all the startup blogs I used to read, all the people I would follow on Twitter, and wonder, like, is the message that they're selling, is this something that's actually good for me or good for the world? Or is it just good for themselves? And is it just good for this very particular model of technological development that is ultimately about keeping wealth in the hands of a very few people, as opposed to actually making the world a better place, which is what the tech industry loves to pretend it's doing? And so, you know, I started reading books. I started just branching out in terms of where I was getting information, following different people on Twitter, finding more critical voices around tech. And in the process, I kind of discovered politics, and especially just very like left politics, because before that I'd only I was really only familiar with, you know, just the mainstream political scene. I thought there was only liberalism and conservatism, and those were the only options. No one told me that there was a left beyond liberalism that involved, say, like unions. I just didn't know anything about unions.
Tell us when there's about the tech workers coalition and other efforts to organize tech workers. What's working out there?
Sure. So the tech workers coalition is still pretty new. It's just a few years old, and it's very it's like a very amorphous group. So unlike Game Workers Unite, there's a much less formal structure, and there's no plans to affiliate with a union anytime soon. It's really just like a group of people, like-minded people, who are interested in what it means to build worker power in the tech industry. And as a result, it draws like a pretty diverse crowd of people. You have people who are, you know, already very politically active. Maybe they organize with like a socialist group or a union or something. And then you have people who have never done anything political in their lives, but they've just heard about what Tech Workers Coalition does, or they like the idea of workers having more power and they just want to know more. And so there's a lot of room for like trying to figure out what this is. The problem with the tech industry is that in a way, it's a bit of a green field industry, in that there haven't been a lot of successful organizing efforts that people can draw on. And so there have been things around adjacent industries or like particular sectors of the tech industry that have had successes. But as a whole, if you think about what it means to organize highly paid software engineers working at Google or whatever, it's a bit of an open question. There are so many things to be resolved. Including the fact that a lot of these people have a lot of stock in the company, right? And so that's not something that, you know, you could really see in like previous industries in the same way. These people have a lot of stock, they have great benefits, great working conditions most of the time, and they're exposed to this very different narrative, this idea that it's, you know, it's a meritocracy. They got to where they are because they're the best, and because they're the best, they deserve more than some of their peers and people who aren't in the tech industry. And so you have a lot of challenges that any efforts to build worker power will have to come up against.
Tell me, Wendy, about your impression of our interview with Declan Peach of Game Workers Unite. You're the expert in the area. Tell me, are there issues facing game workers distinct from other workers in tech? And what are the likelihood of a successful drive in game workers and tech at this moment in time?
Sure. So I wouldn't say I'm an expert in this area. A lot of this is very new to me as well. I only really just discovered the whole concept of worker power a few months ago. And I've been just, you know, trying to read up on and like learn whatever I can from people who've been involved. But yeah, I'm still kind of just like trying to figure this out. But in terms of the difference between the games industry, so a few months ago, I chaired an event for Tech Workers Coalition, which included someone from Game Workers Unite. And some of the discussion there was actually really illuminating. And I think Declan just talked about it a bit as well. But the way I see it is that the games industry is kind of like halfway between Hollywood and, you know, the rest of the tech industry, where, you know, you think about like Google or Facebook or startups. So it's a little bit different because it's this industry driven like by these like hits, right, where you have projects that go on for a while, but then they're done. And it's less stable, and there are more peaks and troughs. Whereas in the traditional tech industry, if a company fails or like goes through a layoff, then that's a failure. That's like not a good thing. That's less common. But in games, it's more the base case. Like that's to be expected, right? You have a big studio that snaps up this game that they're going to be building, and then when that game's done, they lay off all their staff. And this is closer to the entertainment industry, like Hollywood. So it's a bit of a different model. And there's less of an expectation that you're going to be working at a company full time, and as a result, the work is inherently just a little more precarious. But because of that, I mean, what we've seen in Hollywood is that because the work has been more precarious, you have had unions popping up more, just because people need them. Like it's more necessary. And And tech is, I mean, the traditional tech industry is a bit different, right? Because you don't have the same sort of precarity. People do expect to be able to work somewhere for a long time. And they have a higher expectation of being able to switch companies that they want. And so I think it, because of that, it's going to be harder. You're going to see the games industry build worker power a lot more quickly than at, you know, in Silicon Valley proper. So, but at the same time, there are definitely lessons that can be learned about what's happening in the games industry, because they're very similar, similar technical skills, but also similar ideology. So one of the big things with the games industry is that it sounds like a lot of exploitation happens under cover of passion as this this almost like a shield deflecting from the exploitation actually happening, where, you know, bosses are like, oh, it's okay that you don't get paid overtime, or like you should overlook the fact that you're not getting paid overtime, or that your wages are so low, or that your hours are so long, because you love what you're doing, right? Like, surely you're only here because you love what you're doing, and as a result, you almost don't deserve better conditions because you're lucky enough to have a job that you enjoy. And in tech, it's kind of similar, except I would say the conditions are usually somewhat better and wages are often quite good. But there's definitely this idea of passion, and that you should, people who are driven, people who are good workers, are the ones who are staying late and just like working really hard and, you know, doing work after hours, constantly going to conferences, investing in themselves, and who are doing everything they can to make sure they do a really good job as workers. And this is something that, you know, it's starting to creep into other industries as well. But at the same time, it's important to remember that this is good for the employer, right? This is not good for the workers themselves. Workers should not have to constantly being, you know, constantly check their phone all the time, constantly being investing in their technical education just so that they can stay on top of their job. And the expectation is just like, it's just a way of increasing exploitation, right? Like for the company to extract more and more value out of the worker while not having to pay them as much as they're getting, obviously. Sorry, I kind of like went off track there.
No, listen, I mean, I'm just intrigued by that, because it seems that one of the issues that we're encountering here is the fact that a lot of people are highly motivated, highly skilled and highly engaged, and that can be exploited by employers.
Definitely, and this is something that I personally really, really believed in. And it's only, you know, it's only in the last couple of years that I've started to realize how my belief in that kind of worldview was not really good for me, but definitely very good for capital. And so, you know, like when I first started programming and I did a lot of open source stuff, I was driven to do it not because I was making money, because I wasn't making money, just because I loved it, right? Because I really, really loved contributing to projects like that. I love the technical challenges. And that's like that's an amazing thing. And it's wonderful that people get to do that. But the thing is, corporations are exploiting that. They're taking advantage of that. They're taking advantage of it in a way that is good for them, but not necessarily as good for the workers as it should be. Because, I mean, as much as there's this idea that people working these coveted software development jobs in tech are making a lot of money, they're making a lot, but the company is making so much more. There was this, this study that looked at how much Apple was making in terms of profit and how much employees could be making if it was, say, a worker-owned co-op. And, you know, I think it came out to something like $400,000 per employee, and that's including all employees, right? And so it's really important to keep in mind the high salaries in tech relative to the actual profits of tech, because, I mean, most of the money, most of the profits, most of the revenue in tech, they're not going to workers. They're going to capital. They're going to shareholders. They're going to you know, stock grants for, especially for management. Right?
And I think something that should be borne in mind in this conversation is the whole issue of working time. And you mentioned it there yourself in terms of out of hours working. And that's become a huge issue in Ireland. We have a tech and information sector of about 92,000. Now, trade unionization of the sector is relatively low. But a huge issue that we see, for example, in the Financial Services Union, is this whole area of stress caused by out of hours work. Is that something that you've seen in your experience?
I think, yeah, definitely. I think it depends on the company and it depends on the role. So I remember when I was interning at Google, I personally was just a little bit not super enthused, right? So I didn't work on it a lot, like after hours or anything. But I had some friends who did, and they were really keen to impress their manager, or maybe they just really liked what they were working on, or maybe they felt like they were afraid that they wouldn't get a return offer, or they just had to prove themselves in some way. And so they would take their work home. They would stay at work really, really late. They'd be working on the weekends. They'd be reading documentation on the weekend. And they did this for like a bunch of reasons, but ultimately, is this good for the worker themselves? Like, no, because then they're making their lives around work, right? And they don't have the time to pursue other things that they might care about. And this is definitely something that these companies like to encourage, and especially startups. I would say it's worse at a lot of startups, especially if you're an early employee at a startup. There's this expectation that the startup is your life. It's your baby. You have to constantly be thinking about it. I've seen investors and founders write blog posts kind of insulting anyone who dares work a 40-hour work week in Silicon Valley, as if having a life or having a family are things that should be discouraged because, you know, you have to give it all to your startup. And I mean, if you think about, like, who is that narrative benefiting? That's benefiting the people who are going to make money off of this, investors and founders, at the expense of, like, people having actual lives where they work on, you know, where they get to do what they want. And it's making work into this really weird, like, central part of existence when it really shouldn't be.
So tell me just a little bit about what your vision for work in the sector would be. What would it look like?
Oh, yeah, that's a very, very big question. So I guess I can only think in terms of like concrete, like small steps, because right now it's just the way I see it is the way technology is developed is just so fundamentally flawed. Partly like because of the way Silicon Valley works, where you have all this wealth and power concentrated within like a very small geographic area, right? And it's like this very imperialist American way of developing technology. That's a huge problem. The way exploitation works in the industry, that's also a huge problem. And so I guess it's like grappling with an issue of this magnitude is just really tricky. But I think there's some steps that could make things better. So one proposal I've seen being floated is the idea of electing workers to boards. And this is something that Elizabeth Warren, the U.S. senator, has proposed. And I don't think this is perfect. For one, this is something that is already being done in various European countries. And, you know, there it's like it has stemmed inequality increase somewhat, but it's not, you know, it's not a silver bullet or anything. But that could be a first step. At a lot of tech companies, it's this very top-down driven model, where it's the founder or like the executive, the board making all the decisions, and workers themselves, the ones who are actually building the technology that these companies profit from, they have so little say in what actually happens, right? They might be able to, you know, decide how to implement something. They might have some say in terms of technical decisions, but in terms of, you know, actually setting the metrics that guide larger product decisions, they don't really have any say or nor any expectation of a say. And I think that is a huge problem. And one way you counter that is by having worker representation on boards. And this could start small, but it should increase over time. And I think that could also be linked to this idea of increasing employee ownership of companies. And this is something that was proposed in Sweden, I think the 70s or 80s. So there's this thing called the Meidner Plan. And there's like the version that was implemented, and there's a more radical version that would eventually see almost like every company, I think, in Sweden being owned by employees with a majority share. And I think there's something to be learned from there. Like, that didn't go through at the time because for a bunch of contingent reasons, but the whole idea is ensure that shareholders are reduced in primacy and trying to, like, you know, get rid of the power that shareholders have, because, you know, we're starting to realize that shareholders aren't really adding value, and that this shareholder driven model of running corporations is actually causing a lot of problems, especially in the tech industry. And I think the way to push back against that is to give employees more ownership over their companies. And, you know, ultimately, like, there's a larger goal, right? Like, it's not about just giving employees more of a say over their companies and like ending there. The whole point is to shift the balance of power between capital and labor in favor of labor. And then from there, you know, you open up the possibility of like more radical policy proposals happening. Because right now, I mean, we're in a situation where, especially in the US and the UK, but really across the board, union density is declining. Just the power of organized labor has been dropping across the board. And that itself will shift the terrain in terms of the political possibilities. And so if you have unions in, or like some form of organized worker power within the tech industry, this, you know, extremely valorized and glamorized sector one that the media is constantly talking about, and that's actually being looked at as like this way of saving capitalism almost, right? Because this is where innovation is happening, this is where growth is happening. A lot of policymakers are kind of, you know, trying to build their own version of Silicon Valley in their own country. If you have an industry like that, where workers are standing up and saying, we don't like the status quo, we demand more of a say in how things are run, you know, we want more collective power, that could actually shift the balance of class forces throughout, just like everywhere in the global economy. And, you know, as a result, once you shift the balance of class forces, then you open up the door to a very, very different world, a much more radical political possibilities.
Excellent. Wendy, thank you very much for joining us on The Office Block. I want to briefly talk about our last Facebook poll. 75% of respondents said that the younger generations are losing out at work. And that poll came on the back of our last podcast, which was about the generation game. A lot of the questions for our guest today were crowdsourced, so please feel free to contact us with ideas and suggestions for guests for our shows. And now to this month's poll, which is live now on our Facebook page. Tech is making a big impact on our lives, from Airbnb to Deliveroo to Netflix and chill. But should tech companies be more conscious of their responsibility to society? Thanks to everyone who made this podcast possible, our producer James and everyone at the Financial Services Union. And thanks to Wendy and Declan for being our guests this time on The Office Block. Until next time, thanks for listening.